This is Roxanne Reed conducting an interview with Richard Davis.
Is it on now? Richard Davis, University of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. I'm the base professor out there. Today's date is April 11th, 1994.
Okay, well, I just wanted to start off with some very general questions about your influence in music and on the bass instrument in particular. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have responded to these questions by asked by others, but to my knowledge, you haven't done anything that's actually recorded or been documented on tape. I don't know. But who or what influenced you and encouraged you in music, and in particular, how did you come to play the bass?
Well, I've always enjoyed the sound of an instrument. That's why I took it up. The guy who was my major influence was my high school director, mm-hmm. Walter Henry Dyett, who was the music director in the high school, Kusabo, which is where I went. He was also a major influence on lots of musicians that you know by name, probably.
Oh, really?
Oh, sure. He was influenced quite a bit.
I didn't know. Like who?
King Cole.
Really?
Donna Washington. Milt Hinton, and Johnny Griffin, Gene Ammons, Jesse Jarman, Morris Ellis, Jimmy Ellis, I mean, just total. Yeah.
So was he, that's very interesting. I had no idea.
He was the man.
Okay. So was anyone else in your family musically inclined? I mean, did you get influenced?
No, I was the only musician in the family. I had all the encouragement any student would need, mm-hmm. from my family. There was no, nothing standing in the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, nobody else played. No.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you just answered the next question that I was going to ask in terms of receiving the kind of encouragement and nurturing that you did as you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, my cousin, also encouraged me to play the bass. She was 8 years older than I was. And she's always encouraged me to play the instrument. I said, why don't you play it, since you encouraged me right there.
Oh, she didn't play?
No, she didn't
play. Oh, she just wanted to?
And she said, well, girls don't play bass.
Oh, okay.
That's how she thought in those days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I sort of want to move on to, your book, actually, in particular.
The book.
But I want to start out by asking you, do you consider yourself or your music in any way to be politically oriented?
Yeah, anybody who's playing jazz is playing politically oriented music. Because jazz is, first of all, in my estimation, it's a dramatic story of the black man in white society. That in itself is protest against where you are and according to where you would like to be. It's a complaint.
So what was the impetus then for the book? Did you just decide that you wanted to document your own?
Well, the book came through a series of things. First of all, I guess I've lived long enough to have a lot of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And since I like stories, I think I remember stories, and I like telling stories, so it comes out to be a storyteller person. I've been encouraged by some grants I received from the Wisconsin System University, in Madison in particular, and also in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been told I should write a book. People say you should write a book because of some things I guess I related to them. And then, I think I'm going to try to avoid. So it just happens that through the years I've been approached even by publishing companies to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't the right time, because I asked one woman, what would I have to do to write a book? She said, you have to take off everything you're doing for a year. I don't see myself taking off from anything I want to do for you to write a book, because writing a book is not essentially what I am. I'm not a book writer. Mm-hmm. So through these grants and through having to turn in a report in the sense of writings, besides some of them to do with performing, it just happens that I was in the right company to get a lot of help in writing the book, and that's Ruby Paredes. Mm-hmm. She is a person who writes articles, essays, and however you want to do it. So with the subject matter that I'm committed to report in the grants, I would say that it's going to be called a compilation of essays addressed to documenting the music through my life. I will talk about myself and my relationship to my environment and the music in that environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you?
That sounds easy to do to me.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, because okay. All I'm doing is talking to a tape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've lived it already, so it's not like you're creating.
Yeah, it's not like I'm trying to think of something. It's like an autobiography in a way.
Okay.
And I don't think we have to think of an autobiography. Sometimes people have a way of pulling certain things out of your dip that you might have forgotten about.
Yeah.
And Ruby Paredes is skilled at being a historian, mm-hmm. and a political scientist, and just has the brightness and the skills to direct that kind of activity. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy about that, because it makes it all sound easy.
Okay. Well, good. Well, it's good that you can
and you met her, so you probably picked up on something that already.
And well, I did, and she's helped me a lot in terms of some of the things that I might want to ask you or talk to you about. So that's
really
good.
Oh, yeah. She's extremely good at that.
Yeah. Well, this whole idea of protest, when you talk about jazz, would you consider, do you see black music as a whole as some form of protest?
I'm only talking about jazz.
Mm-hmm. Right, in the book, right.
And I can also talk about a lot of music that is black music and non-jazz that is protesting. Mm-hmm. For instance, spirituals, gospels, hymns, things that are written about an experience of wanting to be in a better place, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, Marvin Gaye, that's what's going on?
Yeah.
Over there?
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider it to be a jazz album. When you talk about jazz, you're talking about black people, you're talking about a community of blacks. So no matter what the music is, it all messes out to be the same thing in a sense when you address the category of protest.
Okay.
To me, that was one of the most monumental recordings ever made in the history of music. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
And that primarily in terms of just the message that was presented there?
The message to me, he's talking about love and a lot of things. And the only reason he can talk about love because he has experienced hate. Mm-hmm. Has experienced what hate does. So protest means, in that case, take me from hate to love.
Well, one question I had, and I was going to ask it a little later on, but maybe it's kind of appropriate here. How do you define black music? And if someone says, what to you is a black aesthetic, how would you respond?
When you said that, right away I thought about the church. Mm-hmm. I was raised in a Baptist church. And the music was quite a part of the program. So, hearing that music in infancy and all through my life, and not seeing anybody but black people playing it, I didn't intellectualize then, but in hindsight, I must have seen this being black music. Because when I got older and began to bring other stimuli into my experiences. It didn't sound like the back music I heard as a kid.
Really?
How it sound like what is now, you know, what is called Eurocentric, it's European classical music. So I know that's not black music. That might be black people who write that music, but they're not writing music that is essentially from the black experience.
Okay.
They're meshing one culture into another to write, you know, like, what's the name? Aaron Copland. They say they look at him as the first really American writer of music in a sense of what is usually played in the symphonic literature.
Mm-hmm.
Before then, composers were writing like the old masters, Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky. His music is typically the American sound,
mm-hmm.
which this country is known for its Western culture. The music sounds like rodeo music.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, some of it was named rodeo. So I knew that wasn't black music. So the only black music that I know that was entirely different from any other culture was the music we call jazz.
Hmm.
That was entirely different.
So when we talk about, when we talk about a black aesthetic then, you know, and just, I guess not just black music, but you know, black culture generally, mm-hmm. when we talk about a black aesthetic, and you talk about the music of the church being the essence of what black music is, then do you see in a broader sense this whole idea of spirituality sort of being central or the central focus of what a black aesthetic is?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see jazz as stemming, I guess, from that method?
Sure, I think it's one and the same. If you take a religious experience in a church programmatically and music, you see the same thing you see in a jazz combo. If you take an activity in the church, which is a religious service, that doesn't involve music but just verbiage, you see a jazz combo, you see a congregation, and you see a minister. He says something, they respond to it. He says something else, they respond to it. In a combo, the saxophone player plays something, the band responds to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's call and response. It's an announcement and a reception, an outgoing and a feedback. So then you have matter of fact, in my history class, I will play a minister preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I put on a saxophone player playing a combo. And it sounds just the same.
Do you ask your class what the difference is?
Huh?
Do you ask your class what the difference is?
I tell them what the difference is. There's no difference. The thing is, this minister who is preaching, who is not a musician, is using the same mode and tonality as the jazz musician who's performing. The scale is different. You know the scale is a flat third, mm-hmm. flat five. You're a musicologist, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so it's flat third, flat five, and flat seventh. And the minister preaches with his voice making those sounds. I'm sure if you would speak to him and say, man, that was a nice key you were doing that in, using it, he probably wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Right.
Because he's probably not a musician. And he just was raised in a culture where that scale exists. Ding 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 bang da ding ding bang do bang and then they will do bang 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 going down the road town. That's the same scale that the jazz musicians use when he plays.
There you go.
That's the minor third, the minor, the flat five, and the minor seventh. And then when he says something, say, and then he went around the mountain, and the congregation said, yeah! And he's so and so and so. He said, yeah, well, that's the same thing this is doing. Bam, bam, bam. So it's like a call and response. That's the whole, it's a pendulum. It swings back and forth in complete logic.
Mm-hmm.
So a guy picks up his horn. Well, he's had all that experience listening at the church.
Mm-hmm.
So he picks up his horn, and it relates right back to his own background as a kid.
So when you not meaning you specifically necessarily, but you in general, when we talk about black music, when we talk about jazz, and we talk about white musicians who play jazz,
mm-hmm.
that then to you is the primary element that's missing? Do you believe, maybe I should ask it in a different way. Do you believe that there are white musicians who can play
jazz? Oh, sure. Yeah. They can play it just as well as some black musicians.
But what about that black experience? What about the black aesthetic in regards to that?
Well, what about a black musician playing symphonic and classical music?
Okay.
Same thing. You can adapt to whatever it is that you want to play. And some of these white musicians have had the same experiences as some of the black musicians from other sources. Some of them have been oppressed.
True.
Some of them have not been given their due. Well, when I said that one, I thought about Phil Woods. Phil Woods was playing jazz for many, many years, playing it as good for many, many years. It wasn't until he went to Europe where he got famous. He was famous amongst the musicians. And now he can work in this country because now he's famous, he's a commodity. But do you ever see a film called Jazz in Exile?
No.
By Chuck Franz?
Mm-hmm.
He's right here on this campus, right at Bowers Hall. He did a film called Jazz in Exile and explains exactly what I'm talking about now. Why all these musicians left the United States? Because they were playing jazz and the country didn't appreciate what they were doing. How can you appreciate what somebody's doing if you don't appreciate them?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? If you don't appreciate the black person, how you gonna appreciate things that he puts out?
Sure.
So on a natural scale, averages say, don't praise the music because then you're praising him. And you can't praise him because you're supposed to be the oppressor, the one that's keeping your foot on his neck. How can you praise someone who's down under your foot?
Okay.
That's basically where it's at. Even in my class, I would tell my students, I say, and this is a class where there's about, out of 100 people, there's about 4 blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I would speak to the class addressing the whites. I said, some of you are being criticized just because you're in this class. This class is all about blackness, all about jazz. And I said, raise your hand if you have been confronted on the fact that you are not only studying this music of blacks with a black professor, but you're in the class trying to learn about another culture. That's what you call a nigger lover. Somebody who is not discriminating and put themselves in the stream of acceptance, they're the ones who get criticized. And I said, raise your hand if you fit this category. Guy raised his hand right away. I said, what happened to you? He said, exactly what you just said.
Hmm.
Sure. And this was only 3 weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah. So, it's not like 10, 15 years ago. And I will tell all my students who take my classes, when they're in the combo classes, I said, the fact that you're in here with me, your status will go down a step or two to some people because they don't want you to be around this and they're going to down it. This is not a strange conversation for you, is it right there?
No, it isn't.
Okay. I saw that wrinkle in your forehead. You wonder what's going on. But I tell them that because I want them to know that that's the truth.
Well, I know that you're very straight You know, I know that you're very straightforward with your students about teaching them. Well, because I've talked to people and I've sat in on a few of your classes myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, given what you've said, I don't think that you want to hold back anything or to keep from hurting feelings necessarily. I mean, not that you would intentionally do that at any rate, but that in relating music of the Black experience, that there's a certain amount of frankness and candidness that goes along with that, that some people may find offensive, but then that's the chance that you take.
I warn them before they come to class.
Yeah.
I tell them. I let them know. See, the thing is, when I teach that class, my style of teaching the class is not academic.
Mm-hmm.
It's more or less teaching them the history through them, hopefully gaining the history by the way I'm talking to them. And I say things that I've heard jazz musicians say, and I've said myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them a living history the best I can. Sometimes they don't know that, but sometimes I might mention it. But I tell them, don't be sensitive, but don't take things personal. And I come in entirely improvising sometimes, because that's what a jazz musician does. The syllabus is there, that's fine. But maybe I don't feel like playing that tune today. You know, maybe I don't want to even play that day. Or maybe I want to play all day. And sometimes I look at my watch and say, oh, it's past the time. I guess we better get out of here. You know.
Do you think that your students, by and large, pick up on this sort of improvisatory method or living history, as you say? Method?
Sure, a lot of them do. A lot of them do.
Yeah.
I can imagine some probably don't. And I don't want to put out too much of a platform to tell them what mm-hmm. to expect, because I don't know what to expect myself. And total improvisation is you don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
The only language they can expect is that I'm going to talk English to them. That's the tools.
Uh-huh.
But they don't know how I'm going to use that. In music, I'm using the tools of a scale. Or a card. But how I use them that day and how I interpret them is entirely different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the older students know where I'm coming from, and the ones who have known and have taken my class more than one semester. But I tell them that I'm a very nice fella, and then I might say, well, I like doing nice things, but nobody's nice. You know, all of us have certain attitudes for certain things, certain days.
Mm-hmm.
But nice means stupid in some cases. You might be generally a gentle, kind person, but at the same time, you can be very devilish if something rubs you the wrong way. And I don't like taking any particular bullshit off of students. Like, for example, somebody missed an exam. And then they come up to me and ask, can he make it up? What they ask me to do is do more work for them when they have done the basic work. Wait a minute. And I tell them, see, I don't know if they can call me. If a student calls me and say, Mr. Davis, I know the exam was the day so-and-so has happened and all that, I'm the kindest guy in the world. But don't just let it go.
Yeah.
And then say, well, I was out of town. What do you mean you're out of town? Where's out of town? Minneapolis, that's around the corner to me. So what, it's your grade, how are you gonna protect it? I'm not taking a test, you know. Some students who are A students will call me when they're gonna miss a lecture. I'm sorry, I'm gonna be in class today, Mr. Davis, so and such a thing happened, and I had to get the name off the answer machine, look up the record, and they're A students. You know, so.
Yeah. There's something to be said for that.
Sure. Like I told one fellow who was in my class who said he was going to have trouble from the beginning. And he said, I need this credit, but I'm going to have trouble with your class from the beginning. He was nervous. I said, don't be nervous. I'll take care of you. I'll tell you what to do. you sit down in front, and every time the class is over, you tag it on behind me and tell me how you're doing. And call me every day. Every day. He didn't call me every day. He didn't sit in front. When he gets a bad grade, like 39, which is 20 points below 59, which is failing, and then he calls me and says, can you suggest something? Well, right away I say to that student, why should I suggest something else when you haven't followed the first suggestion? Mm-hmm. I told you what to do, and you said, yeah.
Right.
Now, what I'm going to suggest? You know, hanging around and talking about nothing? Wait a minute. I need that time for a student who will follow suggestions. That's just the way it is. And that's teaching them about if you play a wrong card, you might not get the gig. If you're practicing. One student asked me, could I give him a few points? And he was a basketball player. This goes back about 12 years ago. I said, in all my life, when I watched basketball, I have never seen the opposing team hand the guy the ball and say, throw it up there and you get 3 points. I said, what basketball team do you play with? So I enjoy those analogies. He walked away. Because he knew that he was asking for something that doesn't have on a basketball court.
Yeah.
So why can't he use that technique in class?
There you go.
Earn the points. I was talking to the administrator about this just the other day. And they said, well, students don't realize that when they ask for things, that makes more work for you. Even the legislature probably doesn't realize how much work a professor mm-hmm. does if he's a sincere guy who wants to do good by his students. They don't realize how hard you work for 1 hour of lecture.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But a student who says, can I make it up and give me some extra work? He's telling me you do extra work so I can catch up with what I was supposed to have done. And I came from a school, man, of strict discipline. My music director, strict man. And if he saw you struggling hard, man, he'd come over there and he'd give you as much help as you wanted. But don't let him take 1 second that you dive in.
I tell you.
He'd pick up on that too, man. And that was solid night.
Well, I noticed, and you know, I've talked to others, and of course, as I said, I've you know, seen for myself how you handle your classes, and even how you interact with students on an individual, personal basis.
You talking about me?
Yes.
Oh, I think my students are the greatest people I've ever heard. They're just like family to me. They're part of my family.
Yeah, that's exactly
I need
my
them
point.
Too. You know, I need them to be able to just do my thing, to stimulate what I want to do. It's not like a one-way street.
Right.
And I'm telling that. And when a guy says, well, I was out of town and I didn't call you, I says, why not? I said, I called you once from Japan. You didn't know where I was, but I got a message for you if you want to talk to me. I called you from Japan because you said you want to talk to me. He looked at me and said, yeah? I said, well, if you're my student, you're my student. Distance doesn't matter. And he said, one guy said, well, I never had to call a professor before. Some professors don't offer that to students, I imagine,
mm-hmm.
and don't want to be bothered. And so when you tell them that, sometimes they don't believe you.
Yeah.
Because they never had that experience before.
I think that was probably the case, too, with the guy that you...
I tell him about Lab 5. You know what Lab 5 is?
No.
He called me at 5 o'clock in the morning. I ask you a question and you know the answer. I say, you call me 5 o'clock in the morning, give me that answer. I'm not standing up here just talking to you about something. I'm very serious about this stuff. This stuff is black culture, and I'm as serious about that as I can be serious about anything else in my life. And I want you to know. And if you flunk a test of mine, be ready to wake up 5 o'clock.
Okay.
But the thing is, if a guy can't answer a question, and I say the best time for me to talk to you when I know I'm available is 5 minutes to 5 in the morning. And I say I will pick it up before the first ring stops. And when it starts, I pick up, I say, okay, whoever it is, I know their name. I say, okay, do you have any answer? And they say, so and so and so and so. I say, okay, I love you, going back to sleep. hang up.
And that's it.
That's it. Wow. That's the only way they're going to get the idea that this is serious business. I'm not saying my subject, that I'm egotistical and that my subject is the best thing that's ever going. But if you're in my class, why are you there? So, and I don't like talkers because students complain about that to me, about people talking.
You mean other students?
Other students talking.
Oh, you just, oh, like interrupting or disrupting you?
Just whispering each other, talking. You know? And one of the things I tell them when they go into class, I say, I don't want any talking. Do you agree to this? And they say, yeah. I say, okay, we have a contract, no talking. And it's the good students who complain about the talkers, you see. They're the ones who started it. I didn't start it. And so then I catch them talking, and I tell them point blankly, anything that comes to my head, I'll say. I might not say a word, I might ignore it, but I might say some worst thing they ever heard in life. I say, you're the subject of my mood, but you're the one who takes the chance. And then we had it, man, they're clamoring to get into that class.
So I understand. Yeah.
I wish I had two of those classes.
So, do you believe that black music, in terms of having, you know, a history of black music as you're teaching, do you believe that it has received the justice that it's due in terms of being mainstreamed into
black music?
European
You look at Michael Jackson, you say yes to that.
Well, like in the histories, teaching this stuff, do you believe that the courses have received their justice in terms of...
No, they haven't had a chance to receive any justice. I mean, all this talk about ethnic studies and all that stuff, even the black studies, Afro-American studies, how old is it, 20 years old?
Here?
In any part of the United States.
Yeah.
When did it start, when they started teaching black studies? How long ago?
Probably about 20 years ago, late 70s, early 70s.
Well, okay, let me tell you. I said that for a reason. I didn't care whether you said 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay.
The fact that we are discussing it means that it has not had a fair due.
Okay.
Now, how long has white studies been in? Is there any discussion?
No.
That's what I'm saying. We have to figure out, that's right, wait a minute, 20 years. Well, that's, how old are you, 32, you told me?
Something? No, 28.
There you go. You were 8 years old when it came in. Your mother never heard of black studies. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That means that the white person who's the same age as your mother never heard of them either. And the white person who's the same age as your grandmother never heard of them either. So they must not be important. They don't exist. That's just part of history that we don't even talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when I remember when, see, sometimes I talk in a way that is street talk. And then one student once said, would you just talk a little slower? And I think she was telling me to enunciate. I think she was driving at that point. We had gotten a little friendly. Mm-hmm. And she was saying she didn't understand what I was saying. I said, well, let me give you another study program. I'm not talking my own language, for one thing. I said, plus, I've been trying to imitate and understand what you've been talking about for centuries. Why don't you try and understand what I'm saying for about 15 weeks?
There you go.
You know, try to get to the gist of my rhythm and what I'm saying. Because we all have to listen to each other. I have to listen to my daughter very well sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I raise her, but she talks very fast. And I tell her I can't understand what she's saying. She said, all my friends do. See what I mean? I'm not one of her childhood friends. Uh-huh. I am a friend, but, you know, so I try to understand what she's saying.
Okay.
And I would tell her, you know, if you get tired of people saying, huh, what did you say? I said, you're going to try to say it another way the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay.
But the thing is, I told her that for a reason. I know there's as many blacks as whites who enunciate and talk very, very clear and well. I've seen just tremendous speakers, you know, who black speakers, but I've seen a lot of black talk that was considered to be retarded and ignorant. until they start writing books, retraining some of these teachers, say, that kid is not retarded, that's just mm-hmm. the way he talks. Mm-hmm. You know, it turns out when the kid takes a test that is applied toward his experiences, he's a genius type too. He's just as well equipped intellectual as anybody. But we don't want to give him credit right. because exactly. it's too much work to try to understand what that student is talking about. So you just ignore yeah. him.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me bring this up, and this was something that Ruby made me aware of, and that was, or that is rather, that next year, in 1995, you will be entering your 50th year of playing the bass.
Oh, yeah, she brings it up once in a while, yeah.
And, well, I don't know, it kind of sounded like something, well, that you haven't really given a lot of thought to, but I think it's pretty timely, given the book that you have mm-hmm. in the works, and... I mean, how do you feel about that? 50 years is spanning a lot in jazz.
That might be a good name for the book. My 50th year with the bass. That might be just an
okay.
idea.
Okay.
So what? You have a question about that?
Well, I mean, how do you feel about that? Have you given it any thought? Is there any way in particular that you would want to commemorate that?
How would you makes me think about book? That. She makes me think about that. See. See, makes me think about a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
you know. Sometimes I just want to play B flat on the bass and call it a day, just, you know, play the bass. But C makes me think about a lot of things that, in a sense, are archival.
Sure.
And I think all that should be considered and talked about. I think something will come up.
Mm-hmm.
Something will come up. It's probably... As we're talking here now, and as Ruby knows that I've talked about to her, but not in relationship to what she mentioned to you, but as at this moment, the conception of what you just said, commemorating, I can see a development of the young bassist on this campus. I just did it this past weekend. Mm-hmm. Maybe you heard about that.
Sure, saw some of it.
Okay, well, I'm going to do that just at this moment. It just comes to me that maybe April of 1995, I could pull off this thing on a bigger scale. That would be the commemorative thing, because it's a project that I'm going to do. So why do two projects at once?
Uh-huh.
I have to tell her that, too.
Okay.
Because I'm just hanging out in my head the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was your project, your individual project with the young bassist, and this is the first time that this has been done. I knew that was yours.
That was my whole thing.
Yeah.
I can conceptualize that and pulled it off.
Yeah. And well,
I can't tell you how much help she was.
Uh-huh.
Man, in those last few weeks, with all the skills that she has, I could not have pulled that off. I was in the water was above my head. With all the staff at the university, all encouragement from whatever sources they might have come from, the actual manual sitting down, pounding it out.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot give her enough credit for that.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
So in all respects, then you would consider it a success?
Oh yeah. It was definitely a success.
Yeah.
Plus, she has some great ideas about those kind of organizational things. And I have a lot of energy
mm-hmm.
that sets off, I guess, like fireworks sometimes. But the thing I got planned for next year is going to make this seem small.
Okay. Okay.
And just hearing myself vibrate on this, which that question was, the ideas are coming in.
Good.
That's why it's good to talk to people.
Okay.
Because it bounces off on something, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about now? I didn't see everything that was going on this weekend. Were there many young black bass players there?
Two.
There were only
no,
two.
Two and a half.
Two and a half. Okay.
Well, it could have been one and a half, as far as I know. One was definitely black. One was probably a mix, and one was definitely black, which means they were all three black, I just said that out of having fun.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what one was really.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think I kind of found out later that he was black. But out of all these bass players, which was close to about 65 young ones,
uh-huh.
meaning fourth grade up through high school, he was about two.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I feel that something has been neglected. See, there's a thing about the kids who go into from the fourth, somewhere in the fourth and sixth grade, and I've been told this by some experts, that something dies out in the black kid because something that he is not being given.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly what it is now, but I know a woman here in Madison who is very conscious of that, and she works very hard against it happening. Her name is Ruth Gustafson.
Mm-hmm.
And she has energy galore in trying to get these things going. She is the one, as a matter of fact, who brings this black kid, a boy and a girl, to my office to get instruction. She literally brings him there. And they were at the symposium only one day. I don't know what happened the second day, but probably it was impossible to bring them there. So the girl who was black and this one boy who was black couldn't get there the second day. Now,
well, what do you?
I don't know the parents well enough to know what they were doing to try to get them there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But if it had been my son or daughter, they'd been there if I had to walk there with that bass.
There you go.
But I don't know the parents yet of these children.
Well, what do you see as your responsibility in, at least, you know, in your area, trying to increase young blacks to, the numbers of young blacks who are interested in playing?
What I see as my responsibility?
Or in generally in music, concerning particularly African American children.
What do I see as my responsibility?
What do you see as your responsibility?
Oh, I see that is as much as my responsibility as anybody's. But it seemed like I've never yet had a black student on the south side of Madison that studied bass with me at the university.
Really?
No. There's a kid named Brian Kennedy, who I hope will come to that part. And there's a girl named Marilyn Ocko, who's potentially one who might come like that. But I have to find a time to develop a relationship with them right now. And there's another one named Melissa Colbert. I forgot about her. She's a black.
Mm-hmm.
His white mother and black father. And her personality is delightful. I mean, she's just like a peach, you know. And I got to know her during this conference. And it turns out that I've known her father for 6 years. Peripherally. I mean, not as an acquaintance, but I've seen him around. I've seen him at meetings. You know, he's like meetings where he raises his hand to an issue, and he's very verbal. You know, I've seen her mother around, and she's a sweetheart, the kid who plays the bass. I just hope that she wants to play the bass and has a career. But I talked to her yesterday. I'm gonna form a quartet with this Melissa. I'm telling my responsibilities by telling what I actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Melissa Colbert is her name, and see, when I was at this conference, I was doing everything from being a janitor to the president. When you administrate something, you just got to be there.
Everything.
Okay? Now, every time I look around, if I saw Melissa Colbert, I saw Allison Gipp. Allison Gipp is white as he wants to be and blonde and blue-eyed, I guess, something like that. And I was seeing Melissa Colbert. If you see one, you see the other. If you saw one separate, 2 seconds later, it comes up around the corner, you know. And so I watched this, and I just knew they would have been friends ever since kindergarten and stuff like that, you know. I said, they're really into each other, you know. And then I cornered them. I said, how long y'all been knowing each other? You know what she said? We just met today. Or yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
I said, no kidding. And so then I talked to the teacher of Allison Gipp yesterday, because I like pairing people together who have these personalities types, you know. And the teacher said, well, you know, Oregon is where the girl lives, there's been a lot of racial issues out there in that school. And the teacher thought it was good that Allison was associating with somebody realistically who she liked. And that the school, what if happening at the school, they're not even concerned about. They're just people who like people, each other, you know. And I spoke to Allison Gibb yesterday, asked her what she felt like in playing the quartet. I spoke to Melissa Corbin. I spoke to Melissa Zaroski, who's a... Now, Melissa is 13 too, but she looks like she could be 15. But she's tall and slender. And Heidi Ritter is a 16-year-old kid who plays the bass very well. Now, for this conference, I put Heidi Ritter and Michelle Zaroski together to play a duet because I wanted to put it on TV. And I called Katie Tsai, who is a person on the news,
right.
And she just grabbed the idea right away. And the two of them just worked out well together. Had symposium. Something happened with the music or something like that. I got it on tail end of it. Well, Heidi really saw it. And she just took care of it. Something like that. Gave the kid a lot of attention, a lot of kindness. And when I was talking, they said, well, Heidi really took him aside and did this and this and that. And so then I told the parents, I said, excuse me a minute. So I took him away from them and started talking to him again. And I said, you know what? And I explained a lot of things to him about how things go, you know. And I said, well, one thing I have to tell you. I said, out of all the kids here, you're the only one who has had proper instruction. I said, think about that. And the reason you're upset because you had a strong feeling about things being good and right. Heidi really did it. Nobody answered it. That's just where she conceptualized what was going on and did something about it. And I noticed that during the whole conference. She was around me asking me questions and doing this and said, do you need any help? And bam, bam. I said, yeah, do this, go get that, do that. And one time she worked out something I couldn't even work out with the music howling, you know. But she just has that kind of thing. So I can see the four of them together, man. It should be a powerful group. And I called her last night and asked her to make the arrangements. You find out who has what schedule and get the address and phone numbers correct and all that. See when they're available and we get together and do something. And it just turns out the day that I recommend her for a job.
Really?
Yeah. Of course, line.
Mm-hmm.
With the Michael Cohen's band.
Mm-hmm.
You know about that?
I know it's coming, yeah.
Yeah. And she's able to cut it. She played the part.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
If you play in bass, you my family. This is my play. You know.
Okay. Well, there was one thing that I wanted to ask you about specifically, you know, regarding this sort of taking young people under your wing, and particularly minorities. I know that in 1989 there was a program called the Madison Plan.
Oh, you want more juice?
I'm fine, thanks.
Okay.
A program called the Madison Plan.
Mm-hmm.
That was a volunteer outreach program,
yeah.
Am I correct? And you were a part of that for some time? I understood, too, that it didn't last very long.
What, the plan I had or the Madison plan?
The Madison plan. I think it was new at the time. It wasn't a continuing thing, and that, you know, all sorts of people from the university were involved, and I learned that you played some part in that. Could you?
Well, let me tell you what my plan was. My plan was not part of the Madison plan.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens that the Madison Plan and I guess some other things were happening coincidentally. My plan was non-structural according to UW. I just had an idea. And the reason the idea came to me is because one of my students was complaining at a meeting once about some injustices or some negation of some type. At a meeting where the Board of Regents were meeting, or somebody was meeting. And I looked around, you know who it was? Regina Ryan. She's won some position now in the municipal system. Just voted in to do something, I forget what it is. But when I saw her complaining, And she's a young mother with children. I said, hey, what can I do? And so I started getting all this stuff together with bringing out, I got all this stuff in filed away. I had 150 faculty and staff members ready to go to do something on the south side of Chicago, which was to bring the university to the south side, not the south side to the university. To have these university people go into the south side neighborhoods and teach subjects at the community center.
You did that. Madison, you mean? You said Chicago.
What
do you mean, Madison?
Yeah, well, Chicago. Okay. Town, I said, yeah.
Okay.
So then there was one guy who said, we ought to bring the university into this. And I said, I don't want to deal with the university because bureaucracy doesn't turn me on. And I said, I wanted to do this without that. These guys, I don't even want them to be appearing as professors, just appearing as community people, you know. And I went to all the neighborhood centers. I was in touch with Ann Salton, who was a lawyer in town, and she was the head of the South Madison Haywood Center at that time. So I was talking about community people. Gene Parks was at these meetings, stuff like that. You know who he is?
Yes.
Okay. So then I said, well, okay, maybe it would be helpful if the university would come in because of mailings and typers and all that right. stuff, you know. And I was very concerned, too, because I had a daughter entering school here during that time, kindergarten. But I'm looking 10, 15 years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I would make sure that there was some shape, you know, for a future.
Yeah.
That's why I got involved as a volunteer. So then I met with the head of the centers, not only the centers, but the head that they were, what you call an umbrella, you know. And they were talking about, oh, we should give a statue to Mr. Davis and this and that, and they were all these compliments, which I don't particularly like to hear. And I said, all I want to do is, you know,
all right. I wanted to ask you some questions about your having come to the University of Wisconsin. And I'll start off with something very general, actually, and that is, why did you choose to come?
I didn't choose to come.
Oh, okay.
I guess I made a decision to come after they chose me and asked me to come. I never thought about teaching the university before, but they kept calling me about coming.
You said it kept, like, what, over a period of years, or over a period of years, they
Well, no, they called me 1 year, and I said, no, I can't do that. I said, they got good people out there already. Then they called me again, started asking me all these questions about coming in and stuff. And I said, well, maybe it's time for me to make a change. After 2 or 3 years in New York, I said, yeah.
Okay.
And I just decided to come on out. Once I make my mind up, I usually stay somewhere. I don't flip around that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I came on out here.
Did you
and
ahead?
I said, huh?
No, please, go ahead.
I said, where's Madison anyway? I didn't realize I'd been here about 3 years before they called me.
Mm-hmm.
I was on tour with somebody. I came in here. No, I did I think I did a lecture out here once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have this, and maybe you can respond to this, but in a quote that was taken from a recent issue of Arts Midwest Jazz Letter,
mm-hmm.
And speaking of your reasons for coming to the UW, you stated that it, meaning the university scene, was a much less oppressive environment, and I suppose you mean
as a much less oppressive environment. Where did that come from?
Comparing that, I guess, with New York?
Oppressive? No, it was, now New York has a lot of tension in it.
Sure.
I guess that's what they mean, huh?
Okay. Well, this is what you said, and I guess what I was going to follow that up with was, you know, at the time, and coming in 77, did you really feel that this university setting was less oppressive? I mean, given the
research. No, I didn't know about the university. I didn't know anything about this place. That is a statement, I guess, remote from, it's so isolated, I guess. Doesn't make sense. No, I was saying that in New York there was a lot of tension. Mm-hmm. And after so many years of that, maybe it was time for something different.
Mm-hmm. So you please.
Not saying that this place was less so-and-so, because I didn't know anything about this place.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I don't think I'd ever heard of it when they called me. Madison? Where's that? Mm-hmm. You know. Did that answer that question?
Oh, I suppose so. I mean, I didn't, well, that was one of the reasons I brought it out. I wasn't quite sure what you were getting at there, and you know, I had not read anywhere, at least, that you'd had any experience in a university-type setting or, you know.
Never had. I just looked at this place like, matter of fact, I did everything I could to discourage them from wanting me out of here.
Really?
Yeah, but I just asked them for a lot of stuff, and I thought maybe they get tired of saying yes, I'd make the decision.
Okay. Well, what, and you know, I don't mean to be vague or very general again, but what, you know, as a minority coming here in 1977, of course, this is almost 10 years after, you know, the 1968 big student protests and that kind of thing. What was your experience like coming here in 1977? Was there at that point anything that you could feel that was sort of left over from
no,
the period before?
I didn't feel nothing.
Did you feel, can you just tell us something about it?
No, I didn't feel nothing. See, I looked at myself as, and still do, as an international citizen. I know I've been confronted with things of what you're referring to, mm-hmm. but I look at myself as saying that, in a sense, I'm above some of the things that people personally confront you with, mm-hmm. because they don't know what I know. They don't know enough to do otherwise than what their small brain is telling them to do, okay? So then when I've had confrontations of that type, in some cases, I take a parental attitude. Like looking at a little child who needs to be taught something. I did that with my ex-wife's father. And he came on in later on and said he sorry he hadn't been in sooner. I figured if I had been another attitude, he probably never would have come in because I wouldn't have let him come in. That's just like that, you know. I was practicing also a philosophy of Buddhism called Nichiren Shoshu, and that philosophy made you feel, I guess, somewhat like Malcolm X felt, that he had become a broader person because he had globally practiced something that before he went over there he was practicing on a very small scale. He was practicing Islam or Muslim religion on a very small scale until he went abroad. Then he realized that he was more accepted, generally speaking, than he was here. And he also elected to accept more people after his experience over there than he did here. He accepted whites there. He didn't look at them as devils and that he had to hate them. He knew all this. And that's why he got offed, because mm-hmm. he was doing things that the small amount of people weren't able to do. So he saw a whole big thing that frightened the people who had him corralled into this little corner or wanted him to hate as they hated. You can't do that to other people, make them hate the way you hate. They hate on their own. The things that have affected them personally and for different reasons. He saw things happen in his own family, mm-hmm. you know. So then when I walk around, I sense a feeling of confidence that makes me able to address a situation on hand as it's happening. I know, even today, that when I'm in an elevator with a white woman, she thinks I'm going to take her purse. So all this success about music and awards and all that stuff don't mean a hill of beans. Honorary doctorate degrees have nothing to do with it. That's a classification that people have seen to think is necessary to give people, like patting yourself on the back. You know, the real reward is, can you see a person for what they are instead of what you think they are? That's the best award you can give a person.
Very well stated.
That's an award that that person can give you, because you are not the only one that's judging people. See, the fact is that the criteria for judgment always seems to be on the person who is oppressing people. Mm-hmm. They go on and say, oh, you should practice this religion, you should do this. Now you're civilized, you know. Are we going to approve of your status? Even if a guy is great, they say he's the greatest black musician.
Yeah.
He is not the greatest musician. He's the greatest black one that we know. They might say if a guy is so good, to make a comparison and to make a scale, they say he plays, so-and-so was impressed with him. Vladimir Horowitz was impressed with him when he heard him. Because Vladimir Horowitz is God, and if he likes you, then you must be okay. But wait a minute, who is Vladimir Horowitz? You see what I mean? The comparison is always that the black man is at the bottom. And if he seeks that other level, he is still compared. You remember that, did you ever see a film with I forgot the name of the guy, but at this church that Martin Luther King came in later on. Mm-hmm. Reverend something. I got it. James Earl Jones played the part. I got it on tape.
Okay.
For some reason, I want to call him Reverend John something or something like that. But it might not be the name. But he leaned over to one of the congregation members when this other guy was talking about so-and-so was a doctor, so-and-so in divinity. And he was just preaching how much acclaim this guy had had. And James Earl Jones leaned over to the guy in the pew. He says, do you know what a doctorate? He said something like, do you know what a doctorate so-and-so is? Do you remember this statement? And the guy said, no, what is it? He said, nigger.
I've heard it before.
I mean, I can't go around with a sign saying I'm a professor at the university.
Yeah.
Because it makes people feel like, oh, this guy is different than Love Hill. We can accept him. Yeah, I'm a professor at the university. I'm an honorary doctorate from so-and-so. I have done so-and-so. Now, I got to walk around with a sign to let people know that I'm not like the rest of them niggas. You know, just to get a cab.
Yeah.
Not until that man who walks around without all those degrees and all those other things, when he's accepted, that's the award. There's no award, because an award is given out by the judgment of the foe, of the oppressor. And he thinks he is the one that has to be the one who claims everything is okay. Well, so-and-so thought that so-and-so was, you know, wait a minute, who is he?
Well, do you still practice?
I always wanted to prove yourself, huh?
Yeah. Do you still practice Buddhism?
No. I haven't since, maybe 1980.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still part of my concept.
Mm-hmm. And was that an
The philosophy has taught me a lot, mm-hmm. and I still use that. One of the strongest points in it was compassion for humanism, for each other. That was a strong point, the compassion for humanism. And that gives you a lot of wisdom if you practice that and are able to deal with that when you have to. That gives you the wisdom to really, really control your emotions to the point of bringing forces closer to you than to take them away from you. As strict as I might appear and be at sometimes, other times, you would think that I'm the very closest thing to what you would call an ideal, wise person with wisdom and patience and everything. But I still have the license to be otherwise, too.
Sure.
My father used to say, soft soap does not clean the world. He'd come up with these gems in one sentence. Soft soap does not clean the world.
I like that.
Yeah, he had those gems. God, he had those gems.
Mm-hmm.